Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. It should come as no surprise that Americans are sleeping less today than they have since we started tracking it. And for the very first time, a majority of us, 57%, told Gallup pollsters that we could benefit from a few more hours of shut-eye. Our 24/7 connectivity is keeping us awake and stressed, a combination that's detrimental to our health. Joining us to talk about why we're sleeping less and what we can do to fix it is Dr. Richard Koh. He's the director of two sleep laboratories with Ohio Health. He has experience treating conditions like sleep apnea and insomnia. Welcome to All Sides, Doctor.
Good morning.
So, were you surprised that we're clocking in with fewer hours of sleep than we used to?
Not at all. Obviously, with the political climate that we've undergone the last few years, all the electronics, the financial stresses that people are undergoing, all those things are all contributing.
And women in particular, like particularly women between like about 30 and 50, are getting even less sleep than the average.
Yes. When you're speaking in broad strokes, in general, women sleep more poorly than men. And this has been researched. There's been consortiums on this to try to figure out why. There's multiple factors playing a role here. First are hormones. Women have a whole bunch of hormonal changes throughout their life that certainly affect sleep. Perimenopausal states, menopausal states, premenstrual syndrome, pregnancy, breastfeeding. For some, postpartum depression, they all play a role. They're all known to cause difficulty falling asleep and poor quality of sleep. Additionally, women are at higher risk for restless leg syndrome, which is a known cause of insomnia. And interestingly, women are two times more likely than their male counterparts to get up in the middle of the night to care for somebody, namely children. It certainly fragments sleep without question. And women have a higher prevalence of anxiety and depression, which certainly plays a role in poor sleep. Anxiety, depression, and psychological disease in general, they're deeply intertwined with sleep. When you're anxious and depressed, you're getting poor sleep. And when you're getting poor sleep, you're anxious and depressed. So it's hard to pull apart one without the other coming apart.
So let's talk about hours of sleep that we're getting. I know the general recommendation is 8. So is that a fair mark? I guess let's start there. Is that a fair place to hit?
Well, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine for adults recommends between 7 and 8 hours of sleep. But this is on a bell curve. There are what are called short sleepers, people who only require 6 hours of sleep per night. They're the lucky ones. And there are people who require closer to 9 hours of sleep. Obviously, that can be somewhat, be an impedance on your life sometimes. And the amount of sleep that we require varies by age. Anyone who's had a kid knows that newborns sleep all day, 17 hours of sleep because they need that to develop their brains. As we get older, that amount of time required truncates. Teenagers typically require, 8 to 10 hours of sleep. Certainly, they don't get that. As a father of two teenagers, I can tell you that is absolutely the case. But, it just kind of depends on the age. But as adults, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends 7 to 8 hours typically.
So what happens, I guess, when we get 6 versus 5 versus 4? Does that make sense?
That's a great question. This has been studied by a guy by the name of David Dingus at the University of Pennsylvania, where he did a number of tests, cognitively speaking, on people getting 8 hours of sleep for multiple days in a row versus 6 versus 4. What he found were that vigilance tests, of course, as you might expect, were worse. Concentration was worse. Learning actually was significantly worse. Where people getting 8 hours of sleep, they could learn a task and they could adapt and get better at a task. People getting 6, they tend to lose that ability, actually. And people at 4, they barely slug through the task in general. So, slight sleep deprivation each night can certainly add up. In his study, he actually found that people who were getting 6 hours of sleep versus what they normally get of 8. At 5 days, it was like skipping an entire night of sleep.
Oh, my goodness.
And people who are getting 4 hours of sleep, you know, they reach that total deprivation at 3 days of only getting 4 hours of sleep.
What about catch up? So I sleep less during the week and I catch up on the weekends.
That used to be said that couldn't be done, but it actually can be done. So you can catch up over 2 to 3 days. Depends on the individual, but it is possible to catch up on sleep. Your body certainly craves sleep, and it will catch up. You know, obviously, if you've gone days and days and days without sleep, it might take longer than that. But, you know, it is possible to catch up after about 2 or 3 days for most people.
And it's not just cognitive decline, yeah. Right? There are physiological declines to not getting enough sleep long term.
That's exactly right. So there's cardiovascular implications, namely high blood pressure, heart attacks, strokes, heart arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation. There's things that affect the endocrine system, such as type 2 diabetes that are at higher prevalence with sleep deprivation. There's psychological stuff, like I said before, anxiety, depression, but also those with true psychiatric disease, they can go into psychoses when they're sleep deprived. From a neurological standpoint, sleep deprivation is a classic way to induce a seizure for those that are prone to it. Sleep is one of those things that affects everything.
I want to talk a little bit about insomnia, because it is something that you have experience treating, and it is something that a lot of Americans struggle with. You know, we are more connected to our works, to our friends, to our families digitally than ever before. But in some ways, it makes it really hard to turn off at night. Is insomnia rising?
It is. And when we say insomnia in the sleep medicine world, that means difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep. It used to be unrefreshing sleep as well, although that is kind of fallen out of the definition a little bit the last couple of years. But when you're talking about insomnia of any kind, it starts first with making sure that there's nothing inherently wrong with someone's sleep. Do they have a sleep disorder like sleep apnea, narcolepsy? Do they have a circadian rhythm disorder, which is where the part of your brain that tells you when to go to sleep and when to wake up is shifted somehow? So people want to go to bed later, they want to wake up later, or vice versa. Do they have medical reasons? Are there medications like stimulants? Are there sedating medications on board that are contributing? And if that's all ruled out, then a thorough history needs to be performed where you're really going into detail as far as what someone is doing on a daily basis, what their sleep routine's like. You know, is there a psychological stressor, anxiety, depression that could be playing a role here? And you attack it from that point of view. And you brought up the phones, and certainly there's been research on our phones causing insomnia. And that's got multiple ways that that's contributing. Number one, just the blue light, any light that is, you know, whether it's artificial or sunlight, fools your brain into thinking that it's time to be awake versus time to go to sleep. Secondly, obviously, there's a, you know, an emotional aspect to the content that you're looking at. If you're reading something that's politically charged, it really gets you fired up, or something that's tremendously funny, you know, that certainly can play a role in insomnia. The other aspect is dopamine. So the reason why, you know, people, you know, like posting and get likes and you like watching videos is because you get this rush of dopamine when that's happening. And it's part of the reward circuit of your brain. So it feels good to get that. And this is why it's so hard to stop scrolling through YouTube when these shorts keep popping up. And you just want another one there. My son has told me that he doesn't even want to look at them anymore, but he can't stop himself because he just keeps going because of that dopamine. It feels so good. And dopamine is a wake-promoting neurotransmitter, so it can interfere with sleep as well. It's been studied formally where if you have the phone on for 30 minutes after the lights are out, that certainly contributes to difficulty falling asleep and quality of sleep and difficulty rising in the morning. And just in general, if you're on your phone for greater than 8 hours a day, the same negative factors can play a role.
What about the light from your computer? So if you go from staring at a computer to staring at a phone or a TV?
Yeah, all of it is the same. Your brain can't tell the difference with the blue light. Now, sunlight by far is the strongest contributor to what dictates your circadian rhythm. But the screen, you know, that we have in front of us with the iPads and the iPhones, it's all the same as far as the blue light.
That's a little depressing.
Well, you know, they do have the blue light blockers that you could put on your screen that can help a little bit. But, you know, without question, the phones have contributed to not just insomnia, but, you know, anxiety, depression as well.
Yeah. And speaking of anxiety, like, you know, it can be really hard to fall asleep if your brain is just racing with ideas, with thoughts, with worries. Sometimes I joke that, you know, it'll be the middle of the night and my brain is like, let's go through all the embarrassing social interactions you have ever had by category, starting with the A's.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's called psychophysiologic insomnia, where your brain kind of forces yourself awake. There are different ways to deal with that. You know, this professor by the name of Professor Spielman, anyone who's a Buckeyes fan will remember that name. He came up with this theory for insomnia of the three P's. The first P is a predisposition, meaning that for whatever reason, you're wired for insomnia. The second P is a precipitating event, something that sparks insomnia. For instance, a divorce, a medical issue, you get fired from your job. Something sparks the insomnia. Can't really do anything about those first two P's, but the third P are perpetuating factors, things that you are currently doing that feed the insomnia. And it can be something that's active. I had this one patient who, she got into this habit where every single night she would run through an entire movie line by line in her head. She would watch Indiana Jones in her head every night, and this led to insomnia, you know, lo and behold. And sometimes it could be something more passive. We just, you lay there and you start getting the anxious thoughts come in. There's different approaches to treat this. You know, one is word repetition, where you could repeat a word that is meaningless, like the word the. You say that, it will break that chain of thought, believe it or not. And your brain will forget about what it was thinking, and you can sometimes be able to fall asleep with that. There's something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is a bit detailed to get into. I won't get into all of that.
We've talked about CBT before on this program.
But it's certainly one of the most effective ways of treating insomnia. In fact, it's first line. There's something called imagery, where you can imagine yourself standing by a stream of water and the leaves.
Is that kind of like counting sheep?
Kind of, sort of. The leaves are falling from the tree and they're falling on the stream, and those are the thoughts that are coming, and you can't stop the thoughts from coming. But what's keeping you awake is your emotional attachment to those thoughts. So you imagine the leaf floating away from you down the stream and try to disconnect. You know, and a lot of times people get fired up because they can't fall asleep. It's one of those things that the harder you try, the worse it gets.
Oh, yeah. You never remember falling asleep.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if one of the things that works is doing a brain dump before bed, sort of writing out all the things that you're thinking about or making a checklist, sort of saying, okay, I've dumped it all onto this piece of paper so that I won't forget.
Absolutely. That's called a worry spot in the sleep medicine world. This is where you write down your thoughts, or you record yourself saying all your worrisome thoughts, or even if they're not worrisome, just the tasks that you have to do the next day. You want to do that in a different room, ideally, away from the bed. In general, you want to keep all your sleep in the bed and keep everything that's not sleep out of the bed if you can. So
no TV in the bedroom.
If you're having insomnia, it's not a good idea. Now, if you're not having insomnia, you know, that's fine. If you don't deem it an issue, but as soon as you deem it an issue, then your brain doesn't know what to do. Like, oh, is it time to watch TV now? Is it time to read a book? Or, you know, is it time to go to sleep? And so your bed becomes a place of activation for your brain versus relaxation and falling asleep.
So it's about setting yourself up for success.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, there's this, you know, you'll see stuff online, and I've seen it in doctor's offices before with sleep hygiene. There's this list of things like, don't watch TV before bed, don't drink a cup of espresso right before bed, you know, don't take naps if you're having insomnia. Sleep hygiene has actually never been demonstrated in the literature to, you know, 100% treat insomnia. So that in and of itself, you know, isn't necessarily one size fits all.
That's good to know. So you don't get caught up weirdly in this idea of I have to do everything perfectly on my checklist or I won't fall asleep.
Exactly. Yeah.
I could see how somebody with anxiety would loop in that.
Yeah, the best thing to do is, you know, from a sleep physician's point of view, is tease into somebody's history, figure out what's going on when their insomnia started, and figure out what they're doing. And you got to find that perpetuating factor that's feeding the insomnia, and you target that.
Final question. When is it time to maybe get help? Like, how much lack of sleep, like, should, like, what is a signal that maybe I need a little extra help?
Well, a lot of my patients are there because their spouse has sent them. Or they come in with their spouse and say, I can't sleep because this guy's not sleeping. That's one of the more common presentations. But certainly if you're feeling excessively sleepy throughout the day, if you have issues with cognition, sometimes if you develop a new cardiovascular issue, depending on what that is, that could be a reason to make sure that your sleep's okay.
That was Dr. Richard Coe, director of two sleep laboratories with Ohio Health. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're expanding our concept of wellness from ourselves to our planet. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Keeping our planet healthy can feel like an impossible task, too much for any one country or state, let alone one individual person. But as surprising as this might seem, recycling can be better for more than just the environment. It may actually help our mental health a little. Little hit of dopamine for doing what we believe to be the right thing. Here to talk about that with me is Christy Walters, the coordinator for Sustainable Columbus Green Spot. Welcome back to All Sides, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
So this is kind of a strange, like, I almost want to say a little bit of a woo-woo thought here, but can you walk us through this?
Yeah. So with recycling, I think a lot of people in the sustainability realm completely understand it. And when you are not in the sustainability realm, maybe it's a little confusing. And it might be stressful. It might be frustrating. So I think it's really important to understand that recycling is different everywhere, different municipalities, different locations. And it's really good to find out who your city service is and what they offer and, you know, how you can do it correctly, because recycling right is really important.
Yeah. When you look at the statistics on the number of items that get tossed,
yeah.
it can be its own kind of depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good and bad with the mental health side of it, because we want to just recycle everything that is plastic or everything we think should be recyclable. But that is called wish cycling, when you just want to, I think we may have talked about that a little bit last time. It's like you want this to be recyclable, so you're recycling it, but it's not really accepted. So that is going to just take, as someone says, a longer journey to the landfill. And it's just, you know, you should know the correct things to throw away in the recycling and in the trash can and in the compost bin, because composting is becoming more of a thing.
So let's start with plastics, because I think they're the most confusing when it comes to recycling.
Yeah.
So they all have little numbers on them.
Right.
What do those numbers mean?
So it's just the type of plastic. And actually, different states have been talking about outlawing the chasing, you know, triangle arrows, because that almost seems like greenwashing to some. There have been arguments made that that is confusing for consumers and can lead to, again, mental health problems with recycling, because people are angry about, you know, this says it's recyclable. Well, really, that is just indicating the resin identification code. That's the RIC. So with that, different types of plastics do different things, right? And we're lucky here in Columbus because we have local people who will do things with our plastic that we recycle. Actually, Advantage Drainage Systems, they turn our like pipes underground. So it's really important infrastructure. So there are good uses for recycling some of those plastics. But as long as people understand, you know, again, what is recyclable or what is not. So I did want to throw out a website really quick. If people are not sure, it's columbus.gov/recycle. So the easiest thing to remember with plastics is that, you know, if it is on our list. So I would check recycleright.org. Again, it's different city to city. So in the past, for instance, we used to not accept yogurt cups, and now we do here. So it changes. So that can be a good contributor to happiness when people are like, oh, okay, good. There are people that are producing this, like, I want to be upset with, you know, this certain type of material being produced. Well, then take action, right? So maybe email that company if you really like a certain yogurt, or if you really like a certain product, or you really like a certain grocery store and they're only carrying too many plastics and not enough like glass or aluminum or cardboard or other options for packaging. Email them and talk to them about your concerns. Try to make your voice heard. But really, the city of Columbus is awesome because we have this thing called the Pickup CBus app. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Mm-mm.
So Androids or iPhones, they have a waste wizard. So you can search on there and say, is this recyclable or not? That's another good way to find out those answers. And you can always email me too, greenspot@columbus.gov.
Yeah, I also want to talk about plastics in particular because, let's take the yogurt cup.
Yeah.
You know, you may try your very darndest, but you can't scrape all of the yogurt out
right.
of the cup.
Right.
We got to rinse them before they go in.
That's right. So don't beat yourself up about that. That's another thing that I like to joke about with my husband, because he's saying, we, you know, rinse that out. Or sometimes he doesn't rinse things out because he's just frustrated. He's like, it doesn't even matter anyway. You know, are they just going to throw it away? And I'm like, no, one of the main reasons that things get thrown away is if they're bagged. And so bagged items are contaminating the recyclables. So we want our trash bagged, but not our recyclables. Don't bag it, keep it loose. But peanut butter jars, those don't really get recycled because you can't necessarily get those clean. So use maybe like reuse that for something else. Put like a smoothie in there and get that last little bit of peanut butter out of there. But with plastics specifically, we used to recycle them based on the bottle shape because the melting point. And now we can, again, have end users for that, local people. So again, it's just kind of confusing and frustrating with plastics, but people also get a little bit scared of like microplastics. I don't know if we've talked about that at all yet, but there are definitely reasons to maybe be telling yourself not to stress out, because we can only just do what we can do, right? Like we can't solve all the problems. You're just in control of what you're in control of.
And part of letting that kind of go, ABC News recently did this investigation that was very depressing for me, is that you think when you bag your plastic bags and you drop them, say, in those little recycling containers,
yeah.
they found that the majority of the time they're not being recycled. And
right.
I was like, oh. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and again, kind of locally Columbus, the biggest contributor to contamination is if people bag it. So if you're, you know, rinsing it, that's good. It's not necessary to get it completely rinsed out. But here locally, it's not as much of a problem. You can always contact your hauler. You can always contact 311 if you're seeing issues like that, and they can get you in the right department. It's one of those things with your previous guest talking about like insomnia. You know, some people stay up at night worrying about climate issues, and our waste is one of those. But with our climate action plan with the city, we have an aggressive goal of reducing recyclables going to the landfill by 40% by 2030. And it's 95% by 2050. So we're doing that in ways of like picking up weekly instead of, in the past, we didn't pick up weekly. And that just changed last year. So we're really making an effort. And I think it's also important to know that there are better, quote unquote, kinds of recyclables. So like aluminum and glass are recyclable indefinitely. I was just talking to a school yesterday about, we would do the little infinity symbol and we're like, this is recyclable over and over and over. But plastic and paper and things like that are not recyclable over and over. So again, maybe just choose your materials if you are able to. And if you're privileged enough to think about that, then, you know, go ahead and even spend that extra time contacting producers of like, you know, places that you like to purchase from or things that you like to consume and eat and drink.
I want to ask about cardboard because, well, in the age of Amazon and post-pandemic, more and more of us are ordering online, and the amount of cardboard that we are generating
right.
as a planet is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it is. It really is. So, of course, there's like, you know, refuse it first, right? If you don't need to buy it, don't buy it. You know, reuse it. So of course, my kids, they like to turn them into like forts and things like that. You know, I'm maybe hippy dippy, but I like to unfold it. And this drives my husband nuts because we're collecting it like in our garage, or we're collecting it in certain areas of our house over the winter. And then in the spring, I lay it down as a weed barrier.
Mm.
It's better than a plastic tarp because it doesn't break down into microplastic in your soil, right? But it does help with some of those really prickly, annoying weeds. It can kind of at least hinder some of that growth under mulch or weeds or whatever. But the cardboard is really good for that. So also people put cardboard, if you have like a flower bed, they'll kind of rip it up and put it as like a layer that helps with the water and helps with a lot of different things with soil retention and things like that.
So like under your mulch.
Yeah, exactly. So cardboard has a lot of awesome uses, actually. And it was interesting during the pandemic, there were some studies that showed cardboard being thrown away from businesses, of course, was reduced, but cardboard being, like, not when I say thrown away, I mean recycled, but cardboard being recycled from residents grew because we were sending more things, of course. So I do think that that was one good example of, like, customers speaking up and telling Amazon, like, we don't want all this plastic waste. And they did switch to, you know, more of the cardboard, more of the paper tape, more of the, like, even their plastic envelopes are usually recyclable at the grocery store with plastic bags.
When it comes to cardboard, I actually want to call out pizza boxes in particular, because apparently these are much more complicated.
Yeah, so I would say with a pizza box, this is always a point of contention with, like, everybody, but I will say if you go tour Sweco the landfill or our Rumpke, like our MRF, if you go on a tour, they're free. I encourage everyone to do it. They will tell you that pizza boxes that aren't too greasy are able to be recycled. So that's another judgment call, like the rinsing of the plastic. It's like, okay, you're not going to scrub plastic, like, and put it through your dishwasher before you recycle it, right? A little rinse through is okay. With the pizza boxes, a little grease is okay. Augie, if it's, like, soggy and it's wet and there's holes in it, obviously that's too greasy. But yeah, I usually kind of take out that middle section. That's the mixed material. Usually that's a little bit of plastic, but the actual cardboard box, at least according to my most recent tour of the landfill and of the recycling MRF, which is, you know, they said that a little bit's okay.
What about putting a little bit of it into your garden bed?
The pizza boxes?
The greasy ones, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I do that all the time. I mean, sometimes if you have, like, particular squirrels or rodents or raccoons, like, obviously be careful and just pay attention to it. But also, I'm, like, again, that hippie that's, like, coexist with nature, you guys. These, like, rodents are good. I love possums. I love bats. They eat bad insects. You know, I know that's a topic for a different day, but sometimes our coexisting with biodiversity is a good thing. So just monitor it as long as they're not harming you.
Yeah, I try to make peace with the bunnies that eat my marigolds and all my other plants every spring.
So I've heard, I don't know how true this is, but if you plant a garden for the animals, they won't bother your garden, which I always think is hilarious because it's like, okay, a little extra tomato plants over here and then just try not to touch mine. But it is what it is.
Yeah, last summer we built a fence around our raised garden beds, yeah. And then the rabbits would just sit outside sort of staring at it, like, how do I get it?
Like, thanks a lot, neighbor. Well, I will say, like, mint and certain types of, like, lavender, there are certain plants that you can plant instead of using, like, that coyote pee that people sell in plastic bottles. You know, they sell these things that try to deter animals from their garden beds. And I know this is off topic, but that stuff doesn't necessarily work because once it rains, it goes away or whatnot. So try to do some of the plants that detract, or, you know, like, deer don't necessarily like certain like plants. So mint and things like that.
I will say, if you plant mint in your garden, it's going to go everywhere.
It does spread. Well, so lavender is better. I'm trying to think of others off the cuff, but there's lots of, if you Google it, there are so many amazing plants that don't spread and they're not invasive and they do, like, discourage bunnies and squirrels and all the things.
Quite a number of lilies are toxic to squirrels and bunnies, and they will stay away from them.
I mean, I know that we talk about, like, how invasive honeysuckle and Bradford pears, they're so bad, and English ivy, it just takes over. And I know some things can get naturalized, but, you know, it's just sometimes that stuff takes over and it's really bad, but not edible.
I want to circle back a little bit to the anxiety that some of us might feel about whether we're doing this right. Like, what advice do you have other than take a big deep breath?
I would say, again, to try to learn the resources that are specific to your area. So the City of Columbus has awesome resources and we really are trying. We really do care. But I would also say to know that it's not like you're a billionaire taking a day trip to space. You know, you're not doing these horrible things to the planet. You're just a part of an imperfect system. So just besides just breathing, going out in nature, getting your hands dirty in your garden, trying to read and learn and enjoy the air on your face and just know that you're doing the best you can. Besides all of that, I would say get active on social media. I don't know if this is frowned upon by some, you know, with talking about less screen time. So maybe be specific about how you're executing this. But we call social media the new public square. So it's kind of the town square where people talk and share ideas. So you need to share things that are important to you. If you know resources like Waste Wizard, or if you know something about, like, the greasy pizza boxes that your next door neighbor doesn't know, share that with them. Like, amplify the correct information. I know misinformation and disinformation is a real thing, so try to find out the real answer. And also, you don't have to solve all the problems. Just know that, like, every everybody can't do everything. Just do what you can.
What about recycling fatigue?
Oh my gosh, that is a thing. Actually, one of my coworkers and I were just talking about this yesterday. She's taking a higher education class right now, and everyone was talking about how, again, like the cardboard, they'll set things aside to use it later properly. And when I say use it, I mean give it to, like, there's a TerraCycle.com, if you've ever heard of that. You can buy a box and recycle certain categories. Or with our waste and reuse stations here at 2100 Alum Creek, those are open Tuesday to Thursday, 10 to 6. But, you know, people will save things to take them there. And then maybe they live in a small apartment and they get a little overwhelmed with this collecting pile that's getting bigger that they need to take. Or batteries, they want to take batteries to a certain place. Or so, like, yes, it's good there are solutions, but I completely understand how people can get fatigued with that. I would just say, again, you don't have to be perfect, like progress, not perfection. And just if you have questions about where to recycle certain things, like, don't beat yourself up. Just reach out.
I want to ask about paint.
Yeah.
That is a very specific and interesting one, because pouring it down the drain, not a good idea.
No, that's real bad. Kitty litter. You put kitty litter in it. There are other things that you can do. There's actually really cool reuse options for that. Different companies are popping up like, oh, hey, you know, give us some of your extra blah, blah, blah. And paint can be on that list. Like, if it's still usable, places will use it. Even art classes, elementary schools, things like that. So just find an alternative, but definitely don't put it down the drain.
Last but certainly not least, clothing.
Okay, there are so many cool things you can do.
Besides Goodwill.
Yeah, so Upper Arlington has something called Swap Day UA. The city of Columbus definitely does some cool things, like OSU students will have pop-ups where they swap clothing. And Reusapalooza is in Westerville, and Precycle Day is in Worthington. So there are different communities that it's more than just clothing specific, but there are communities that are trying to divert things from the landfill that aren't recyclable. So things like clothing, again, maybe just do a clothing swap with your friends, or maybe sell it, you know, Poshmark, Strata. There's different like apps that you can sell on if you have time for that. But
and there's also like Clothes Mentor,
of course,
Once Upon a Kid, all
yeah.
those kinds of
oh,
like
yeah.
more brick and mortar.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And if they're like specific to, you know, like nice business clothes, it's like Star House. That's like they'll give those to older teens that want to interview for jobs or things like that. So it depends what the type of clothing is. But yeah, if you have questions, I'm happy to point you to a resource.
That was Christy Walters, the coordinator for Sustainable Columbus's Green Spot. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Coming up, how do you get out of a boring conversation? We're getting tips from a psychologist on how to end that talk without being, well, a little rude. It's coming up in just a minute on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We've all been there, trapped in a conversation you wish never started. You don't want to be rude, but you also don't want to stay stuck in a dull discussion. So how do you get out? Extracting yourself can feel like mission impossible. Experimental psychologist Adam Mastriani studies conversations, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Adam.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I want to begin with how humans signal we're done with a conversation, because it's not always with our words. So what are some nonverbal cues that we've just lost interest?
Yeah. Well, the problem with cues like this is that they tend to be so ambiguous, right? The kinds of things that people do when they're ready to leave a conversation are things like break eye contact, or allow a long, awkward silence to persist, or start fidgeting, or all of which are things that you might also do when you are uncomfortable, or you're thinking, or you're just a person who needs to move around a lot in a conversation. And I think this is part of why it's so difficult to know when someone else wants to go, is that the signals that often feel so clear to us are not very clear to the other side.
And sometimes we might be the boring ones in that conversation. And I know when I get excited about something, I can be a little, well, insufferable. Like, I can't wait to share all of the things very excitedly that I've learned. You know, when we're so excited about what we're talking about, I think it can be really hard to notice that the other person has really lost the thread of conversation.
Yeah, I think of this as, I wrote a piece about this called Good Conversations Have Lots of Doorknobs, that basically, a good conversation is one in which the other person can grasp onto something. And we usually think of doing that as asking them questions, which is a good way to try to make doorknobs for the other person, something for them to grasp onto and so they can participate. But I think actually invitations are also a good way, that like to make a statement that the other person can respond to in some way, to set out an opinion, to stake a claim. These are basically providing on-ramps into participating in the conversation. And so I think when you are, when you've trapped someone else, basically you have sent them down a highway where there's no exit ramps. And so they can't leave without causing a lot of damage to themselves or to you. And so this is the way that I think about trying to have good conversations, is to create opportunities for the other person to participate.
So how do we create these opportunities for other people to participate?
I think so. Often it is using a question mark, although I think people think that just asking any question in a conversation is, you know, doing your due diligence as a conversation partner, but not all questions are made equal. So some questions, so I've watched a lot of people have beginning conversations, or like introductory conversations in the studies that I've run, and people ask questions like, so how many cousins do you have? Just like a dead end, right? Because like, there's no interesting answer to that. Nobody wants to list their cousins. And so the kinds of questions I think that actually create meaningful opportunities for the other person to engage with are what I think of as like asking about internal states. Like, how did you feel when you were doing that thing? What is it like to be the kind of person that you are? To ask about stories, anecdotes, like how did you make that decision? How did you come to be here? People love telling you their life story, and actually a lot of people's are more interesting than you might expect. Or for asking someone to say a little bit more about something that often, I have six cousins isn't that interesting. But like, you know, I used to be really close to my cousins and now I'm not. Like, now we're starting to have like the beginning of a thread of something that might be interesting, like how family plays a role in our lives and that how that role changes over the course of our lives. But there's no substitute for actually being interested in someone else and for them being interested in you.
Yeah.
These are hacks on top of that. Yeah.
Yeah. David Sedaris, the writer and sort of very well known to NPR audiences, has said he likes to ask strange or really unique questions, like, when was the last time you touched a monkey? Because there's always a story, right? It's sort of it's a fun, non-threatening way to bring people into a conversation.
Yeah, you hit a brick wall when someone's like, I've never done that. Like, okay, well, flipping through my list of strange questions, when was the last time you touched a giraffe?
So let's talk about when you want to escape, but you also don't want to hurt the other person. You know, you don't want to roll your eyes or just be blunt and cut the conversation off. How do we get out of these situations?
Yeah. Well, I think it helps to know the kind of predicament that we're in the first place. So these studies that I ran a couple of years ago on one conversations, and you know, we put people in a room, people who never met each other before, and told them to talk as long as you want to, and just let us know when you're ready to move on. And afterward, what people reported is that they didn't talk as long as they wanted to, and that happened for two reasons. One was people didn't want to speak for the same amount of time. So it's impossible for us to both get what we want if we don't want the same thing. And the other is that they had no idea when the other person wanted to leave. They were basically guessing randomly. They were off by about half of the length of their conversation. So like, how do you get out requires first understanding the problem, which is we don't want the same thing. So someone's going to be at least a little bit disappointed by the end of this. And the other is that I really don't know when you want to go. And so I think the best way out is to first try to have a good time yourself. Try to make the other person have a good time too, but know that like, we're not going to be able to thread this needle. And yet people really do enjoy these conversations more so than they expect. So you don't have to thread the needle in order to have a good time. So some ways out at the end I mean, the biggest problem with ending a conversation is that it always feels like you're rejecting the other person. Well, if we were really having a nice time, wouldn't we continue doing this until we both drop dead? And the answer is, of course, like, obviously we got to go do something else. And so the way I try to do it is I try to solve that problem of like making it clear that this conversation isn't ending because something has gone wrong. That, like, I had a perfectly nice time talking, but all good things must come to an end. And so too must this conversation. And so something as easy is just like, hey, it's been lovely talking to you. You know, I should get going, or like, you know, you probably have a lot of stuff to do. And there's a good chance that the other side actually wanted to go before you anyway. This is how I got into studying this in the first place, is I thought like, going to this party, I'm going to be trapped in the conversation. And then I thought, well, what makes me think that I'm special? Like, I could be trapping the other side. And that could well be true. So it's not always escaping. It is also letting the other person out of the cage.
I've always loved the particularly passive aggressive, let me let you go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, everybody knows what's going on at the end of these conversations, right? And so I think, you know, a little politeness where we maintain the fiction that is exactly what's happening is fine, because we know that, like, we got stuff to do. We can't talk all the time. And in our studies, you might think that the people who left saying I wanted that to go on longer would have been disappointed, or maybe felt like they were, you know, dismissed rudely. In fact, they had as good of a time as the people who said it ended exactly when they wanted it to. So the people who said, I got exactly what I wanted, were just as happy as the people who said, I wanted more. And they were both happier than the people who said, I wanted less. So actually leaving people wanting a little bit more is as good as leaving them with exactly what they want, and is definitely better than leaving them with too much.
Oh.
We can always talk again. We can never talk for less than the time that we talked now. Oh, you don't get that time back. We can have more in the future. So if this is good, we can come back tomorrow or a month from now or later on in the party. If it wasn't that good, that time's just gone. We're never getting it back.
Oh, so the showbiz cliche, always leave them wanting more, is actually true for conversation.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know, we almost didn't even put that question in the study because we thought obviously everybody's going to want to go at the end of their conversation. Otherwise, why would they? But no, like a sizable proportion of people, in fact, in 10% of conversations, both people left saying, I wanted more. They had time left. They could have kept talking. They both wanted to keep talking, but they stopped. They both had a good time. And part of the reason they stopped was thinking like, oh, well, I shouldn't keep, you know, I'm having a good time, but I don't know if you are. So I think it's not just that conversations, you know, go poorly and people get trapped. It is also that they are, they're part of what makes life worth living, is spending time with other people. And I think this fraught moment at the end of a conversation can obscure the fact that, like, actually talking to people is really great. And it's a lot better. There's a bunch of studies on this, some of which I've done myself, that it's so much better than people expect it to be before they enter it, especially with new people.
Are there any different rules or considerations for ending conversations with your children?
Well, you never really get to do you? You kind of got to keep talking to them. But I mean, younger kids have to learn what the rules and norms are, right? That I'm really sorry that I can't keep talking to you right now. Like, dad has to go back to work. Kids aren't born knowing how these things work. And so I think it's fine to instruct them. It's funny though. I've only been on the child side of that conversation. I'm not yet a parent. So maybe a parent would know something I know about the interminable conversations that you have with your children who won't shut up.
I think it's a delicate balance because you want to encourage them to share their thoughts, their feelings, their dreams. Mm-hmm. Like, you want that connection with your kids more so than maybe almost anybody else on the planet. But sometimes they just keep going and going and going. And you definitely don't want to discourage them from coming to you with these things.
Yeah, yeah. Which I think, like, the same thing that we the same fraughtness that we find with people we don't know well, we actually find the same thing with people that we know really well. So that one study I told you about was strangers talking in the lab, but we ran another study where we surveyed people about the last conversation that they had, which is overwhelmingly with people that they know really well and talk to all the time, some of whom are probably their children. And we find exactly the same thing, that these conversations do not end when people want them to end. The difference between the amount of time that people talk and the amount of time that they wanted to talk was about half of the length of the conversation, so a difference about 50%. And so, this doesn't just happen in the laboratory, it happens in the living room too. But the fact that it happens with the people that we love the most, on one hand, is like, wow, we can't even land the plane with people we talk to all the time. On the other hand, it's like, well, but we love those people and we really enjoy being with them. And so, yeah, okay, so we can't hit the bullseye here, but that's still okay. And in fact, like it might not be that easy or even possible to you get closer to the target. But it might be possible to worry a little bit less about it, because we know from a lot of these studies that people are really anxious about conversations, and as a result, like engaging them less than they probably would otherwise if they understood how pleasant they tend to be once they're inside them.
It's weirdly a little bit reassuring that we're all more awkward about this than we think we are, like collectively as a human race.
Totally. Yes. There's some other research about awkward silences in conversations where people tend to blame themselves for it. But like, obviously, on average, it can't be your fault specifically. Like, sometimes it's the other person's fault, too. Every person can't be responsible for every awkward silence. We know, too, that, in our studies, when you ask people, like, when I describe my study to people, I put people in a room. I tell them talk as long as they want to. How long do you think they talk? People are like, 5 minutes. I'm sure it's like, it's awkward. It's terrible. They hate it. And they probably get out as soon as they can. And like, actually it's 30 minutes. Like it's so much longer than that because people kind of get into it. And as soon as you sort of cross that first barrier of getting to know somebody, it's like you're rolling downhill. It gets a lot easier. But it's impossible to see how you're going to overcome that barrier before it happens. You won't know what you have in common with this person until you discover it.
You say that there are certain points when we can enter and exit a conversation more easily. What are these like on and off ramps?
Yeah, it's funny that there's so little known about these because they're so powerful and so intuitive, but they are so unspoken, right? Like you and I can feel right now that if you were to shut off, like if you were to disconnect, I'd be like, that wasn't really where the conversation was supposed to end. Right in the middle of someone's story, you're not supposed to leave. In the middle of a statement, you're not supposed to leave. If someone leaves a big cliffhanger, you're not supposed to leave. If someone asks you a question, you're not supposed to leave. And we know all of these rules intuitively, but we maybe can't even articulate all of them. But like it is entirely about feel. Some of my friends told me a couple of years ago. I was like hanging out at their house. We were like having a party. And I think I kind of like finished my thought. And I was just like, all right, I'm going to go. And to them, it was not the right time. And they told me for weeks afterward, they were shaken by the fact that I just stood up and left. Because like to them, it wasn't an off. To me, it felt like an off ramp. I was like, all right, it's kind of the end of the night, like time to go home. For them, it was like we were just heating up. So they're both intuitive, but also not always, people aren't always on the same page about them.
This is kind of a weird question. What lessons can we take from rats about ending conversations?
And when was the last time you touched a monkey? I don't. Are you thinking of a certain study? I think rats don't really talk, so I think this might be easier for them. But I imagine that like whenever a rat is hungry, they just go eat and look, there's something beautiful in that. But I also think that like there is a reason why, humans have civilization and rats don't. It's because there's like a little bit of social niceties that we are willing to tolerate in order to live in communion with one another. So that would be my answer to your strange question.
You know what's funny is I think sometimes great conversationalists are kind of like we know it when we see it, right? Like that person that seems mm-hmm. like it's effortless, they're the life of the party, everyone wants to talk to them, they tell these great stories, and it feels like almost like you're born with it or you're not.
It's funny when what you just described about a great conversationalist, I think, is actually a huge turnoff to some people. But like some people are very entertaining to listen to, and some people are very entertaining to talk to. And I actually think of the second kind of person.
And there's a distinction
as a good
there,
conversationalist.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, a good storyteller, I'm happy to listen to, but a good storyteller doesn't necessarily want to hear my stories. And so, like, if what I'm looking for is like a performance. I might be happy to talk to them. But like performance is not the basis of friendship. If I want to actually have a relationship with someone, I have to be a storyteller sometimes too. And so I think the kind of person who's really good at holding people's attention is not always the kind of person who's really good at having a long conversation with. Those people are maybe, they're maybe less entertaining, but they're much more engaging, if that makes sense.
No, it definitely makes a lot of sense because I think telling a good story is a different skill than having a good conversation.
Yeah, I think about this as the difference between stand-up comedians and improv comedians. So in my other life, I do some of both. And the kind of person who's a great stand-up comedian is really entertaining to listen to. That's what they do. Their job is to like to entertain an audience who's sitting quietly and is waiting for them to say the things that are so funny that everybody should shut up and listen to the jokes. An improviser works completely differently. Like, I don't have anything to give you other than what we create together. And so you shouldn't sit there quietly and listen to me. Like, you should talk to me. We're going to discover something. And I think both of these have their roles, but actually the kind of person you want to talk to is an improviser. So it's better to be an improviser than a stand-up.
That was Adam Mastriani. Thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.